Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we try to unpack complex topics and give you clear, actionable insights. Today, we're diving deep into something really critical: initial assessment and diagnostics in polytrauma management. Think about it. These are the highest stakes situations imaginable. Someone has multiple severe injuries. And those first few minutes, even seconds, they're absolutely crucial. Knowing what to look for, how to read the signs, and well, what to do next can literally do the difference between life and death. Our mission today is really to give you a solid understanding of the core principles and also some of the cutting-edge tools that guide medical teams in those first crucial moments. Polytrauma, severe multiple injuries, is not just a medical emergency. It's actually a huge public health issue around the world. It's the number one cause of death for children and young adults under 45. And the burden on society is immense. We're talking costs that can go over 2 million euros per patient in places like Switzerland. So understanding this initial phase is kind of your shortcut to being truly well-informed about a vital part of modern medicine.
Okay, let's unpack this.
It really is. The initial assessment in polytrauma, it's a masterclass in thinking clearly under extreme pressure. And what's truly fascinating, I think, is how the teams have to move beyond just, you know, listing injuries. They have to actively manage immediate life threats, often several at once. You know, a lot of standard textbooks may be focusing on just one fracture type or general surgery. They often lack that comprehensive roadmap for these really complex situations. This deep dive, hopefully, will highlight that real-time clinical decision-making. It's so dependent on experience, and it helps you understand not just what they do, but why these rapid choices matter so, so much.
Right. And at the very core of all this polytrauma care, there's this powerful, almost primal directive. Treat first what kills first.
Mm.
Sounds simple on the surface, doesn't it?
Deceptively simple.
Yeah, but actually applying it consistently, especially in chaos, needs a really structured approach. And that's where protocols like the Advanced Trauma Life Support, or ATLS, come in, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. ATLS principles are, without doubt, the bedrock of trauma care globally. Mm-hmm. And the origin story is pretty compelling. It came from Dr. James Steiner's own experience. He was an orthopedic surgeon who crashed a small plane. He and his family were badly injured. And he realized the care they received initially in a small rural hospital was just inadequate because there wasn't a standard system.
Wow. So his personal experience directly led to this structured approach.
Exactly. It highlighted that critical need for a reliable method, which guides what we call the primary survey.
Okay. So the primary survey is like a systematic checklist. What needs attention first?
Precisely. And the core of it is the ABCDE algorithm. It's designed specifically to help prioritize when so many body systems might be failing at the same time. Each letter stands for a vital area.
Let's walk through it then. A.
A is for airway with cervical spine control. This is number one. Absolute priority. If a patient can't get air in, nothing else we do matters. So ensuring that airway is open and clear is paramount. And right alongside that, almost simultaneously, we protect the neck and spine, usually with a rigid collar. You have to prevent making any potential spinal injury worse. Like the saying goes, ultimately, only sufficient air and oxygen will keep the patient alive.
Makes sense. Okay, so airway secured, C-spine controlled. What's B?
B is breathing and ventilation. Once the airway's clear, the focus shifts. Is oxygen actually getting into the blood? Is gas exchange happening in the lungs? So out in the field or right when the patient arrives, this means quickly checking the chest, looking, listening, feeling for signs of injury. If breathing isn't adequate, you get hypoxia, lack of oxygen, which can cause lasting damage, especially to the brain.
Okay. A, B, now C, circulation.
C, circulation and hemorrhage control, yeah. This is often where you see the really immediate visible threats. Obvious external bleeding needs to be stopped right now. Direct pressure, dressings, sometimes even tourniquets.
And you mentioned something really interesting earlier. Sometimes C comes before A and B.
Yes, that's a critical point. In cases of absolutely massive life-threatening hemorrhage, like a partial amputation spurting blood, you have to stop that bleed first. We sometimes call this C-A-B-C-D-E.
Yeah.
The C with an exclamation mark jumps the queue because that massive blood loss will kill them faster than anything else.
Wow. Okay.
And for internal bleeding, which you can't always see, like from a shattered pelvis, applying a pelvic binder quickly can be life-saving. It compresses the pelvis, helps stabilize it, and reduces the space where blood can pool. Same goes for splinting severely broken long bones, like in the thigh. It reduces pain, bleeding, and further damage.
Got it. A, B, C. What's D?
D is for disability, which is really about neurological status. How's the brain function? We use the Glasgow Coma Scale, the GCS. It's a standardized way to quickly check someone's level of consciousness.
How does that work?
It looks at three things. eye opening, verbal response, and motor response. You get points for each. 15 is the best score fully awake. 3 is the lowest, completely unresponsive. We also quickly check their pupils. Are they equal? Are they reacting to light? And we check if they can move their arms and legs. This all gives clues about potential brain or spinal cord injuries.
And E.
E is exposure and environment. Basically, you need to undress the patient completely to do a full exam, look for hidden injuries, but at the same time, you have to prevent hypothermia, keep them warm. Trauma patients lose heat very quickly, especially if they're bleeding, and getting cold makes everything worse, especially clotting.
So that ABCDE structure provides a rapid, repeatable way to tackle the chaos. And that C adaptation really drives home the treat first what kills first idea. Now let's get into the specifics. How do these principles apply when looking at injuries in different parts of the body? What tools do doctors use?
Right. So armed with that ABCDE framework, clinicians then use specific diagnostic tools and look for specific signs depending on the suspected injury location. Let's start with the chest. Very common site for serious injury.
Okay.
The initial check is always hands-on. Clinical evaluation, checking chest wall stability, listening for breath sounds, feeling for any crunchiness or crepitus, assessing their work of breathing, and we're always monitoring their respiratory rate and oxygen saturation with a pulse oximeter. But what we're often on high alert for is something immediately life-threatening, like a tension pneumothorax.
Tension pneumothorax. Mm-hmm. Sounds bad. Can you break that down? What is it?
It's really bad. Imagine you get a hole in the lung or the chest wall that acts like a one-way valve. Air gets sucked into the space around the lung with each breath, but it can't get out.
Oh, wow.
So pressure builds up inside the chest cavity. It collapses the lung on that side, pushes the heart and major blood vessels across, and cuts off blood flow back to the heart. It hits both breathing and circulation. Very dangerous.
And how would you spot that?
Clinically, you'd look for severe difficulty breathing, maybe veins in the neck bulging, decreased or totally absent breath sounds on the affected side. And if you tap on the chest, it might sound unusually hollow, kind of like a drum. We call that hyperresonant. But here's a key pitfall. Those bulging neck veins. They might be absent if the patient is also in shock from bleeding because their overall blood volume is low.
Right.
And tracheal deviation, where the windpipe shifts, that's actually a very late sign. You rarely see it in time. The key takeaway is if you suspect it clinically based on breathing difficulty and decreased breath sounds, you don't wait for an x-ray. You treat it immediately. Decompress the chest with a Likert needle, usually in the second intercostal space. That converts it to a simple pneumothorax, buys you time, and then you put in a proper chest tube. It's life-saving.
So clinical suspicion trumps waiting for imaging in that case.
Absolutely. But imaging still plays a huge role, of course.
Like chest x-rays.
X-rays give you initial clues, yeah. But really, for chest trauma, the computed tomography scan, the CT scan, is the most important exam. It's just much, much better at seeing rib fractures, lung bruises, we call them, contusions, collapsed lungs, pneumothorax, and especially injuries to the big blood vessels like the aorta.
So when would you typically get a CT?
Generally, it's recommended for pretty much all multiply injured patients. Anyone you suspect has a significant chest injury if the initial x-ray looks abnormal or if they're having trouble breathing.
But there are downsides.
There are. Cost, radiation exposure, which we always have to consider. And importantly, you usually have to move the patient out of the main trauma resuscitation area to the CT scanner. And that takes time, requires staff, and might not even be possible if the patient is too unstable. Plus, not every hospital has a CT scanner immediately available 24/7.
Okay. Moving down the body then to the abdomen.
Yeah.
Big concern there is hidden internal bleeding, right? How do you find that quickly?
Exactly. The go-to tool for that initial rapid check is the FAST exam, focused assessment with sonography for trauma.
So, ultrasound again?
Yep. It's quick. You can do it right at the bedside. It doesn't involve radiation, and you can repeat it easily. The main goal is to look for free fluid, which in trauma we assume is blood in specific spots around the heart, liver, spleen, and pelvis.
Sounds useful.
It is, for a quick look. But, and this is a big but, its overall accuracy, its sensitivity, and specificity are generally only moderate, maybe 60-85%. It's not good at actually characterizing injuries to solid organs like the liver or spleen, just seeing if there's fluid around them. And it's notoriously bad at picking up injuries to hollow organs like the bowel or injuries to the diaphragm or pancreas. Those can be easily missed on FAST.
So a negative FAST doesn't mean everything's okay.
Definitely not. It just means no major collection of free fluid was seen at that moment. It's more of a triage tool, helps you decide maybe who needs to go to the operating room urgently, but it doesn't rule out significant injury.
So what if the FAST is negative or maybe unclear, but you're still worried about bleeding in the belly.
Mm.
Or the patient's vital signs just aren't stabilizing.
That's where sometimes diagnostic peritoneal aspiration, or DPA, might come in, though it's used much less commonly now with better CT access. It's a simple, quick, but invasive technique. You insert a small needle or catheter into the abdominal cavity and see if you can draw back blood.
More direct.
More direct, yes. And actually has a higher sensitivity for detecting any intra-abdominal blood compared to FAST, maybe closer to 89% versus FAST's 50% in some studies. But again, it's invasive.
And for the patient who is stable enough, not actively crashing.
For the hemodynamically stable patient where you suspect an intra-abdominal injury, the gold standard is definitely the CT scan.
Okay.
CT gives you fantastic detail. Accuracy is very high, like 92, 98%. It's excellent for seeing solid organ injuries, figuring out if free fluid is blood or something else, and even spotting small amounts of free air, which could mean a bowel injury. Ideally, you do it with intravenous contrast dye to really highlight the organs and blood vessels.
But the same limitations apply as with chest CT.
Exactly the same. Cost, radiation, needing to transport the patient, needing specialized staff to interpret it quickly. It's a balancing act.
Let's shift to head injuries. We touched on the GCS, the Glasgow Coma Scale, earlier. How central is that in diagnosing traumatic brain injury, TBI?
It's absolutely fundamental. The GCS score is how we initially classify the severity of a TBI. Mild is a score of 13 to 15, moderate is 9 to 12, and severe TBI is defined as a GCS of 3 to 8. Interestingly, the patient's best motor response, how well they can move their limbs purposefully, that single component is often the most reliable predictor of their long-term outcome.
And you said it needs to be checked repeatedly.
Critically important, patients with head injuries can deteriorate very rapidly, so you have to reassess and document the GCS frequently. And crucially, it's the post-resuscitation GCS that really matters for grading the TBI severity.
Why post-resuscitation?
Because initially, a patient's level of consciousness might be low simply because they're in shock from blood loss, meaning their brain isn't getting enough blood flow or oxygen. Once you've stabilized their circulation and breathing, their GCS might improve. That improved score gives you a clearer picture of the actual brain injury itself.
Right, which leads to what you call the lethal duo.
Yes, hypoxia and hypotension, low oxygen and low blood pressure. These are absolute enemies of the injured brain. Even short episodes where the systolic blood pressure drops below 90 millimeters of mercury are known to be independent predictors for poor outcomes after TBI. They essentially double the risk of dying.
Wow.
And if you combine low blood pressure with low oxygen levels in the blood, mortality just skyrockets. So the main goal, the absolute priority in managing TBI early on, is preventing secondary brain injury. The initial impact causes the primary injury, but we fight hard to prevent further damage from lack of oxygen, low blood pressure, high carbon dioxide levels, or even low blood sugar.
How do you manage that?
Well, patients with severe TBI, usually a GCS of 8 or less, almost always require immediate intubation to secure their airway and guarantee oxygenation and ventilation. And when giving fluids, we prefer isotonic solutions like Ringer's lactate or normal saline, rather than solutions that could potentially increase brain swelling.
Okay. Let's talk about the pelvis and spine. These often involve massive forces, right?
Yeah.
What's the focus there initially?
Huge forces, yes. Pelvic ring injuries can cause devastating internal bleeding and have very high rates of complications and death. So the immediate life-saving step is often applying a pelvic binder or even just wrapping a sheet tightly around the hips at the level of the greater trochanters.
What does that do?
It essentially squeezes the pelvis back towards its normal shape, reducing the volume of the pelvic cavity, which helps tamponade bleeding from broken bone ends and torn veins. It provides temporary stability. Beyond that, drawing blood tests right in the trauma bay, like lactate and base deficit, helps us gauge the severity of the shock, the overall physiologic insult to the patient's body. And specialized blood tests that assess clotting, like Rotem or TEG, can guide us on giving blood products precisely.
What if the binder isn't enough and the patient is still unstable?
If they remain unstable despite initial fluid resuscitation in the binder, they often need urgent surgery. This might involve placing an external fixation frame on the pelvis or a procedure called preperitoneal pelvic packing, where surgeons pack gauze internally around the pelvic brim to directly stop bleeding.
And for the spine?
For suspected spinal injuries, especially after high-energy blunt trauma like falls or car crashes, the key is spinal precautions. Minimize movement. Keep the patient flat. Maintain their head and neck in a neutral inline position, usually with a cervical collar and maybe blocks. And if you absolutely have to move them, use a log roll technique, keeping the head, neck, and torso aligned as one unit.
Are those long backboards still standard practice?
They're used for extrication and transport, but there's definitely scrutiny about keeping patients on them for extended periods in the hospital. They can cause pain and skin breakdown, pressure sores. So there's a big push for early, appropriate clearance of the spine based on clinical protocols. If a patient is awake, alert, sober, has no neck or back pain, and no neurological deficits, they often don't need prolonged immobilization. One specific point for certain types of neck fractures, like cervical facet dislocations, if you suspect there might also be a slipped disc involved, getting an MRI before trying to realign the spine is strongly recommended. Trying to reduce the dislocation could potentially push a disc fragment into the spinal cord, which would be catastrophic.
Right, okay. And finally, the limbs. What's the big immediate concern there besides obvious fractures or bleeding?
A major time-sensitive concern is acute compartment syndrome, or ACS.
Compartment syndrome, what is that exactly?
Think of muscle groups in the arms and legs as being enclosed in tight, non-stretchy fibrous sheaths, like sausages encasing. These are the compartments. Trauma, especially fractures of long bones like the tibia in the lower leg, can cause swelling and bleeding inside one of these compartments. Because the sheath doesn't stretch, the pressure inside the compartment rises rapidly.
And that cuts off blood flow.
Exactly. That increased pressure squeezes the blood vessels, compromising blood flow to the muscles and nerves within that compartment. If it's not relieved quickly, the tissues can die, leading to permanent muscle damage, nerve injury, even amputation.
How do you diagnose it? Is it obvious?
Diagnosis relies heavily on clinical suspicion, understanding the injury mechanism, and then a careful physical exam. Key signs are pain that seems way out of proportion to the visible injury, pain with passive stretching of the muscles in that compartment, firmness or tenseness of the compartment, swelling, and sometimes numbness or weakness later on. You can measure the pressure directly with a needle device, but relying solely on a specific pressure number, like the old threshold of 30 mmHg, can be misleading.
How so?
Well, a pressure of 30 might be tolerated okay by someone with normal blood pressure, but it could be devastating for someone who's also in shock with low blood pressure. So clinicians now consider the difference between the diastolic blood pressure and the compartment pressure, the delta pressure, as a more reliable indicator. But often, the clinical picture is enough to warrant surgical decompression, called a fasciotomy.
It's clear this initial assessment is complex and rarely just straightforward ABCDE. Let's talk about some situations that add even more layers. What about pregnant patients?
Ah, yes, a really important group. When any female trauma patient of reproductive age comes in, the very first step, non-negotiable, is a pregnancy test.
Why is that so critical right at the start?
Because while saving the mother's life always takes priority, the best thing for the baby is a healthy mother. We have to be mindful of the developing fetus, especially regarding radiation. Radiation exposure from diagnostic imaging, particularly CT scans, carries the greatest risk of causing birth defects, especially in early pregnancy.
So do you avoid CT scans then?
Not necessarily, and this is the crucial balance. If the mother is unstable, if she has suspected severe injuries where a CT scan is needed to make life-saving decisions, then the benefit to the mother absolutely outweighs the potential risk to the fetus. You perform the necessary scans to save her life, but you don't do them unnecessarily. Having a radiologist involved right from the beginning is essential to help make those complex decisions. Maybe modify protocols to reduce radiation dose if possible, but never at the expense of the mother's diagnosis and treatment.
That's a tough balance.
Yeah.
What about completely different scenarios, like mass casualty incidents? How does assessment change when resources are just overwhelmed?
Mass casualty incidents, MCIs, completely change the game. The usual approach where you try to do a lot of stabilization and treatment at the scene before transport the treat and go idea often has to be drastically scaled back. Due to the sheer number of injured people, maybe ongoing safety concerns at the scene, first responders might have to prioritize rapid evacuation with minimal intervention.
So patients arrive at the hospital less stable?
Often, yes. They might arrive with significantly less pre-hospital care, maybe more unstable, maybe colder, maybe with bleeding not fully controlled. This means the hospital teams have to be prepared to perform interventions in the emergency department that would normally have been done, pre-hospital securing airways, decompressing chests, controlling hemorrhage. It puts immense strain on hospital resources, too. It's a stark reminder that protocols have to adapt to reality.
So it's really not just a single snapshot assessment at the beginning, is it? It has to be ongoing, especially looking for things like shock.
Exactly right. It's a continuous process. After you've run through ABCDE initially, secured the airway, started breathing support, the persistent question is always, is this patient still in shock? Or are they developing shock? You need dynamic clinical assessment checking heart rate, blood pressure, mental status, urine output, but also objective lab markers. We mentioned lactate and BACE deficit earlier. These are crucial for tracking the degree of physiologic insult, how much the body's metabolism is struggling due to lack of oxygen delivery. And we also need to watch for and manage coagulopathy problems with blood clotting. Trauma itself, plus bleeding and resuscitation, can wreck the clotting system.
And that's
Very serious. Patients who develop coagulopathy after injury have a much higher risk of dying. So continuously monitoring and addressing these endpoints of resuscitation, normalizing lactate, BACE deficit, temperature, and clotting function, often using those rapid Rotemtegg tests, is vital. If a patient shows these high-risk signs, ongoing shock, hyperthermia, acidosis, coagulopathy, it often signals the need for what we call a damage control approach.
damage control.
It means prioritizing immediate life-saving surgeries, stopping major bleeding, controlling contamination from bowel injuries, but delaying more complex, definitive repairs. You do the bare minimum to keep them alive, stabilize them in the ICU, correct their physiology, warm them up, fix their clotting, restore blood volume, and then bring them back to the operating room later, maybe 24, 48 hours, for the definitive reconstruction once they're stable enough to tolerate it. So, yeah, that initial assessment, it's not just about listing injuries, it's about making these rapid, repeated decisions to stabilize the patient, bridge them to the next phase of care, all under intense pressure.
Wow. We've really covered a lot of ground here in navigating the whole intricate world of initial assessment and diagnostics in polytrauma. From that fundamental urgency of the ATLS ABCDE to the smart use of tools like FAST and CT, it's so clear this phase is just this high-stakes blend of expert knowledge, speed, and really critical decision-making. And we've seen how specialists have to adapt, whether it's managing the unique challenges of a pregnant patient or responding during the chaos of a mass casualty.
Precisely. And the ultimate goal always is to reduce those preventable complications and improve the chances of survival. But here's something to think about, a question maybe to leave you with. We've talked about the incredible precision and the rigor of these protocols and diagnostic tools, right? All focused on life-saving. Yet studies, historically at least, have shown that maybe less than half of trauma patients actually receive adequate pain relief before they even get to the hospital.
That's a really stark contrast, isn't it? All this high-tech, high-speed assessment focused on physiology, but maybe overlooking the patient's immediate suffering.
It raises a challenging question, doesn't it? What does this tell us about the ongoing challenge of balancing those immediate life-saving technical steps with the, well, the broader scope of patient-centered care right from the very first moments? It's kind of a provocative thought, I think. It pushes us as healthcare providers to always be looking for ways to improve that holistic care, to better integrate managing pain and distress, even in the most urgent, chaotic situations. How do we optimize both?
That is a profound thought to carry forward, how to maintain that human-centered approach amidst the life-saving urgency. Whether you work in a high-stakes field like this or you're just navigating complex decisions in your own life, those principles of structured assessment, prioritizing the biggest threats first, they're really invaluable. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive today.